This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Support for The Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. This week, more negative headlines for the prestigious New Hampshire prep school, Phillips Exeter Academy. The school is reeling from allegations of sexual abuse by two teachers, some decades old, and some during the time when Governor Maggie Hassan's husband, Tom Hassan, was principal of the school. Republicans have noted Hassan's campaign ties to one of the abusers. Hassan herself commented on how this incident was handled.
I continue to agree with the school that they appear not to have gotten the balance between privacy and transparency after they forced the teacher to retire and leave campus.
The governor spoke on WMUR-TV. Meanwhile, in economic news, the state's unemployment rate dropped to 2.6% in March, the lowest it's been since the year 2000. According to economist Brian Gottlob, this could lead to higher pay for some Granite State workers.
We're really approaching full employment, and it's going to be very difficult for employers not to increase wages. I think they've been able to do that for some time because of the excess, the slack in the labor market. That's no longer the case.
And it's Discover Wild New Hampshire Day tomorrow at the Fish and Game Department, and some outdoor enthusiasts will likely be buzzing about the agency's withdrawal of a proposal to authorize 50 permits to hunt bobcats. Fish and Game Director Glenn Normando admitted he faced vocal public opposition to a state bobcat season.
We're very confident about our science and the numbers of cats that are out there and whatnot. But obviously there was a large contingent of people who didn't want anyone to have a season on hunting them.
It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Give us a call, The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can always find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for the week are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Dean, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Gary, thanks for helping us out.
Oh, you're welcome. Great to be here, Laura.
And Josh Rogers is here, NHPR's senior political reporter. And Josh, thanks to you, too, for being here.
Good morning.
Well, gentlemen, let's start with a difficult story. Phillips Exeter Academy, another week of negative headlines for the school, announcing a second faculty member had to leave after admitting to sexual encounters with a student more than a decade ago. And Gary Reno, I'm going to throw this to you first. The school said it was hiring a law firm to help it investigate allegations of sexual misconduct on campus. What can you tell us, Gary, about some of the continuing news that came out of this story this week?
Well, the school turned over some more names that came forward after the first round of publicity about this. There were four people's names that they turned over, evidently, to the Exeter Police. One of the people that was involved was a Steve Lewis, who is a current faculty member who has resigned and has been barred from campus. And the Exeter Police put out a statement yesterday that said basically this one we're dropping because it's beyond the statute of limitations. But there are three others that they are continuing to investigate. Obviously, if they're hiring on a firm to go the school itself, they're concerned that there may be more than this going on and that they want to expand it and make sure that they've covered their bases going forward.
Josh, jump in there, please.
Well, one thing that was also interesting that was reported in the Union Leader was a letter that was sent by Phillips Exeter under the signature of then-Principal Tom Hassan to alumni in 2013 that talked about allegations surrounding a long ago teacher, Thomas Wood, who had been employed by Phillips Exeter in the late 60s and was dead at the time of the letter that said that there have been allegations raised about this man, and the guy was named, and the letter said, we haven't received any other complaints regarding Dr. Wood, but I want to alert you to these allegations. And that was in 2013. You know, obviously this guy was dead. You know, it's a different approach than Exeter took in 2011 when the Rick Schubart allegations first surfaced. You know, a more rigorous approach to notifying the public. But it is interesting to see that it was there was a change, and this did go out under Tom Hassan's signature. Obviously, the school made a different call 2 years earlier with Rick Schubart, who is alive and still a member of the faculty.
Well, and this has been politically troublesome, right, Josh, for Governor Hassan, with her husband being principal at this school and all these allegations.
Yes. I mean, we don't know where this is going. And obviously, it's not like Governor Hassan was principal of Exeter. But this obviously took up a good deal of the news attention during a week when Medicaid expansion had passed. And she would have clearly rather been talking about that or the Senate's failure to move on the Garland nomination or any number of other things she thinks may help her politically. You know, we don't know where this is going to go. You know, we'll see what comes out of this investigation that Exeter launches itself.
Well, late last week, Senator Kelly Ayotte called on the governor to be more transparent about her campaign ties to one of the former teachers at Phillips Exeter. Here she is talking with NHPR's All Things Considered host Peter Biello.
I don't obviously know all the facts, only that even in what has happened so far, she's given several statements. Some of them are different. And so I think it's important just that she clarify and offer as much information as she can about this matter.
Again, that's U.S. Senator Kelly Ayotte talking with NHPR's Peter Biello late last week. Josh, go ahead.
Well, I mean, one thing that's interesting is that Kelly Ayotte issued a statement on Senate letterhead saying that the governor had not been consistent in her answers. And there is some truth that the governor's answers haven't been entirely consistent. But a lot of people, I think, were surprised that Senator Ayotte would wade into this herself on Senate letterhead when, you know, we don't know where this is going. This is something that Republicans obviously are hoping that this will be a vulnerability for Governor Hassan. Ryan Williams, who used to work for the state GOP and is now a Washington-based Republican consultant, you know, was unmasked last week, you know, using a Twitter handle that was followed by three people at the time it was reported in the Union Leader. Fire Tom Hassan. Tom Hassan is still being paid by Phillips Exeter, but is going to be taking the air as the president of School Year Abroad, and it was calling on that organization to fire him, and it had these, you know, a sort of a meme-style poster where it had Tom Hassan and, you know, Cardinal Law and, you know, a pretty aggressive. And, you know, that Twitter feed has gone dormant since it was reported on. But obviously Republicans are hoping that this will be something that will hurt Governor Hassan. And we don't know if that's true or not.
Go ahead, Dean.
Yeah, it's interesting. You played that clip of Peter's interview with Senator Ayotte, and I listened to the whole interview. And Peter does a really good job of pushing her. I think in the actual interview, he comes back to her three times to get her to clarify what is it exactly that she's looking for in terms of information from Governor Hassan. You know, I think Josh is right. I think Republicans are kind of hoping just to sort of keep this out there and maybe get a little bit of traction, even though, you know, Governor Hassan was not a principal of Phillips Exeter. And I've talked to a number of Democrats who are angry about this. They think it's kind of a cheap shot that, you know, she's already sort of said what she said on it. But I thought it was a really interesting interview because it's not really – I mean, you sort of sense that Senator Ayotte is kind of keeping it out there, but even she's not really sure what she's looking for. And I thought that really came through in Peter's interview of her.
Well, Dean, beyond the politics of this, you know, around New England, I mean, we've been talking about the St. Paul's story on this program a lot. And then there was a school in Rhode Island where sexual abuse allegations emerged and other prep schools around New England. Parents are starting to say, look, what's going on?
Sure. Well, you know, these elite boarding schools are a different world. They don't have the kind of transparency that you may see in other educational sectors. They tend to be slower to change. They have these cultures that go back in many cases over 100 years. And you have a group of minors who are typically under the full-time care of people that are not their parents. So there's always going to be concerns there. It's interesting to me that although the St. Paul's episode was very recent, a number of these that we're talking about, we're talking 2-3 decades ago, which is a very different time. I think kind of by today's standards of transparency, we're starting to learn about a lot of the stuff retroactively. And I think you're going to see these boarding schools try to catch up, but they have been kind of slow to change, and their transparency has been an issue for some of them.
Josh.
Well, it is interesting. I mean, in full disclosure, I attended the school in Rhode Island that is, under scrutiny. And when I was there, I mean, there are teachers that are being looked at who were teachers when I was a student. And, you knew they were kind of creepy, but, that was the reality. And I do think it's also interesting that some of the lawyers involved in the pursuit of some of these incidents at St. George's, the school I attended, one of them is this Eric McLeish fellow, who's a big lawyer who was involved in some of the clergy sex abuse in Boston. And, he also attended St. George's, and he said he's been pretty frank that essentially this is almost like a new front in going after, institutionalized sexual abuse, pedophilia, however you want to put it. And that, the Catholic Church was one front, and now it's moving to other places where there would be opportunities for predatory behavior by adults and roles of supervisor and care. And so, this is something that we'll see where this goes, but this is not something that is confined to, one school.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. The name McLeish, when you said that, I thought, oh, I've heard that name before. So that's where that comes from, Josh. All right. Well, gentlemen, turning to another story that has been creating headlines, for weeks now in the Granite State, concerning the chemical PFOA. This week, the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services expanded its testing radius for wells that might be contaminated with PFOA. The source in question is a plastics plant in Merrimack. And again, this week, DES, Department of Environmental Services, extended the radius to 1.5 miles of the plant. Gary, why the expansion?
Well, every time they keep testing, they find more and more of it. And as they're going out, they're finding that even for a mile and a half, which is a pretty good distance from the plant, that the levels are high enough that they want to be want people to have bottled water, that they don't want them drinking the water anyway, that it's above what most would consider good levels. You don't want to see them as high as they are, even out a mile and a half. And also they did some testing of the water right at the plant and the soil right at the plant. And the water at the plant had some very, very high levels of it. And so now they're going to be doing some more testing at like schools, parks, and daycare centers. I think there are 8 sites that they're going to be testing beyond what they said before because they're concerned. I mean, we're not talking about wells in Manchester and Litchfield and Bedford. It's really growing as we keep going. I mean, it's obviously a problem, and it's gotten into the environment in a big way in around that plant.
Dean, beyond, again, this expanded radius, sure, a lot of headlines around this, what sort of other policy or politics issues does this story raise?
Well, I mean, these kinds of episodes get to the heart of the debate over kind of a regulatory regime, sort of what should be the extent of state and federal regulation of private businesses and when does it become too onerous for companies. The reality is a lot of times with these sorts of issues, you don't really know there's a problem until there's a problem. So people just kind of go along about their business, assuming that things are safe, and then you find out later that this is actually a problem that has to be dealt with. And, there typically is federal funding to deal with and these kinds of environmental issues and testing, but it's not what it once was. And there are these sort of larger debates in Washington and also at the state level about, how much regulation and testing and rules are too much for companies. So, and it was interesting, I read an interview with the CEO of this particular, the Saint-Gobain Performance Plastics, kind of hedging on whether or not they really are responsible for this. So I think this is going to be kind of going on for a while. Even though they are providing bottled water, the CEO is saying, well, let's wait to assess where the blame should be placed. The other thing I will say is I was watching an infomercial the other night, and it was for a nonstick frying pan, and it said PFOA free.
Okay.
And I now know what that means.
Gary, go ahead.
Well, I mean, we have this whole question, as Dean brought up, between the state and the federal regulations and what's going on there. And I think people probably don't know this, but the Department of Environmental Services in New Hampshire is largely funded with federal money.
Almost
entirely funded with federal money. And, of course, the federal money has been going down.
Yeah, there's less of it.
All the time, so there's less and less of the federal money to go around. So what used to be maybe tests done every 2 months is now maybe tests done every 6 months and so on. So there's an impact when you start cutting the funding for the Environmental Protection Agency.
Well, it's interesting, too, Dean. You rarely hear politicians calling for more regulation, as you said, but in this instance, politicians on Capitol Hill are saying to the EPA, please come up with a standard and soon. I think Gene Shaheen talked about that this
week.
Which
is interesting because so much of the discourse about the EPA at the federal level has been dismantling it and scaling back regulations. Republicans have been large critics of the EPA and overreach by the EPA on standards. So yeah, I mean, you know, this is a pretty scary thing for families. A lot of people have been drinking this water for, you know, children for many years. We don't know what the impact will be. So sure, maybe this is a case where there'll be some emergency funding to help deal with the problem. But it's a very scary thing for the families in the area.
And there's still lots of tests that the results haven't come in yet. There was a real backlog of tests. There are very few sites that apparently, at least according to the DES folks, that do this sort of testing that needs to be done. And so they led the executive council to believe that they basically have those labs occupied full time for the time being doing the testing.
Well, since you mentioned the testing, I was surprised to learn, Josh, that there are no labs, as you said, in New Hampshire that do this testing. There are labs in the state that have been busy collecting water samples to get PFOA testing then sent to those out-of-state labs. Our Morning Edition crew talked to Andrew Nelson. He's owner and laboratory director of Nelson Analytical Lab in Manchester. And he said he's been fielding calls from all over the state about PFOA.
A couple weeks ago when this first broke, we were getting, you know, a few calls a day. And that's increased at this point to, you know, I would say right now we're getting somewhere between 20, 25 calls a day at least. With concerns over PFOA. We are seeing concerns from areas that are nowhere near those towns. So it certainly has increased awareness to this particular chemical throughout the whole region. And we are getting calls from all over the state.
Again, that's Andrew Nelson, owner and laboratory director of Nelson Analytical Lab in Manchester, talking to NHPR's Morning Edition. And gentlemen, this PFOA story is one we will no doubt be talking about week by week. It is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. And let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And gentlemen, let's go to the phones. And Linda's calling from Newfields. Hi, Linda. Go ahead. You're on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Welcome.
Thank you, Laura. I just have a quick question, a follow-up to the conversation about Senator Ayotte's use of Senate stationery for a campaign comment. I didn't receive one of those, but I'm positive she wouldn't have used the franking privilege to mail that out to constituents. But isn't there something unethical about the use of Senate stationery for a campaign remark?
Linda, thanks for the call. What are the rules around that, Josh?
Well, I mean, to be clear, this was an email statement to the press. I don't think this was mailed to constituents.
I see.
And, you know, there's obviously a political aspect to it. If you wanted to defend this as Senate business, you could say this is an institution where, you know, thousands of children are educated and there are questions being raised about whether they're being properly protected from predatory behavior. That's something a senator could comment on. But I do think it is true that the statement that Senator Ayotte made was first reported in the press and then, or at least told to a reporter, and then it was, you know, sort of pushed out to her mail list of reporters. So
okay, so it was an email to reporters, not necessarily official Senate letterhead
or something
sent to every
sent
household
to
in New Hampshire.
Exactly.
Okay. Dean, there are sometimes questions, you know,
yeah,
about it's tough for incumbents sometimes, you know, they need to walk a fine line.
Yeah, and it is true the franking privilege the sort of free mail to constituents is a big resource advantage for incumbents. Most incumbents have staff who are pretty good at walking that fine line. They obviously have to keep the campaign operation separate. But if you look at the kind of the nice glossy brochures that members send out with all their accomplishments and all the bacon they bring home to the district or the state, it's a fine line, but they're aware of where that line is. And this is an interesting example.
Linda, thanks for the call. Coming up, we're used to hearing about super PACs in presidential and congressional races, but one super PAC says its focus is the New Hampshire State House. We'll find out more. Stay with us for the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're catching up on some of the top Granite State headlines of the week. And as always, you can join us. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests this week are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website NH Political Capital, Gary Reno, Statehouse reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, and Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter. And gentlemen, let's turn to the legislature for a moment. And Josh, just remind us, where is the legislature at this point? Here we are, mid-April, in terms of getting the work that it needs to get done for the year.
I mean, if this were a horse race, you'd say they're rounding the far pole at this point. Most of the big bills have been dealt with, second year of a session as you head into an election year, and there's no budget to wrangle over, tends to get done sooner. There are, financial issues that remain to be seen how they are resolved given the state of our revenues and some business tax proposals that are pending. But, they're looking towards the summer and thinking about the fall, some of them too.
So the first year of the session is a budget year, and that always goes almost all the way up to the wire, Josh, right? June 30th is the deadline. But in a non-budget year, they might finish up by May.
I don't know. What do you think, Gary?
June 1st, probably.
June 1st, okay.
I mean, the thing about the second year is you may have the budget dominates the first year. The second year is often dominated by hot-button political issues, like the abortion and guns and things like that. And we've had a lot of those bills. Most of them are done with, but a lot of them are still hanging around in one place or the other. But they haven't taken over like they have some years.
Yeah, I've noticed that.
What we still are still in the midst of is all this drug crisis bills are still being talked about here, there, and everywhere, particularly one with the drug courts, which is now before the House Finance Committee. And the chairman of the House Finance Committee is Neil Kirk, who's never liked the throw money at anything, let's put it that way. And he's going to be taking a very close look at it in the next week or so, and because there's several $1 million that's at stake here that could be available to counties if they want to start drug courts.
Well, and speaking of the drug issue, you're right, Gary, there's been a ton of legislation on that and some still outstanding. I wanted to ask you guys about a House committee looking at a Senate bill to add parental opioid use or a baby's drug addiction, and it even hurts to say that, to think about a baby being drug addicted, to the definition of child abuse and neglect. So, Gary, what comes with that definition? I mean, why is this so important?
Well, if the police or the DCYF wanted to move on a parent because of child abuse or neglect, one of the things they want to add is that if the parents are addicted to drugs, this would be one reason that they could take children, if you will, or have greater oversight, give the guardianship to a parent, to a grandparent or something like that. The other thing is if people were a little concerned that you start playing around with the definition, then you're going to start opening up another can of worms. So they were more concerned in the Senate that we keep the law the way it is, but we just sort of give a wink and a nod to this whole issue and say, you can add this to the sort of the reasons that you want to move on this case, but it's not going to be part of the definition of child and abuse.
I see. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the way the statute works is it talks about essentially the condition of the child, and they don't define the behavior of a parent, and so that was a concern in this, and you know, as passed by the Senate, and there was a little bit of a fight over this, and it was ultimately amended. It actually sunsets this language regarding drug use. I think 2020 was when that would go away. The aspiration of the Senate would be that by then there would be a lot less of this going on, and therefore you would not need to have that language in there. We'll see in 2020 if that gets there, and we'll see what condition the bill comes out of the House. But there was a real concern about defining behavior of a parent in the bill in a way that, you know, may or may not. I mean, you know, a sort of real libertarian argument might be that, you know, just because I'm doing X doesn't necessarily mean that my child is being harmed. And now that's, you know, a decision that lawmakers can make. But
there was some concern, right, Josh, among doctors that if you put this strict definition in there that, you know, drug use, opioid use adds up to child abuse and neglect, that women wouldn't seek prenatal care because they'd be afraid DCYF would, as one lawmaker said, swoop in and take their baby away.
Yes, and so it's a you know, these laws are try to strike a balance, and it's going to be interesting to see where we end up on this one.
Well, and Dean, this gets into this larger conversation that we've been having. A much bigger awareness this year in New Hampshire, more attention on child protection, and whether tougher laws or more resources or some combination is needed. We've been talking about this a lot lately.
Yeah, and I think it's been driven by the high visibility of the opioid crisis, both here locally. It got picked up into the presidential race and was kind of put out there nationally as well. It's obviously not a problem just for New Hampshire, but we certainly have been up towards the top of the list per capita in terms of overdoses and overdose deaths. And it is part of a big – there's a lot of overlap here. We've talked about it in terms of Medicaid expansion, that this population that is most likely to be vulnerable is also most likely to be served by Medicaid. And you do have to – I mean, a lot of the discussion – that we've talked about is this kind of sort of law and order versus treating the addiction and how do you make sure you have a safe environment in terms of law enforcement while not, as you just suggested, disincentivizing people from seeking help and treatment. So this is interesting. This is the most I've heard about kind of the debate over treating an addiction versus whether or not it's a crime and how you balance that. And there's been some pushback from law enforcement, but they're also in a new role, and so they're kind of coming to terms with that as well.
Well, you can see this play out in a debate, and this is not a fresh debate by any means, over how to handle marijuana and its possible decriminalization. This is something that's passed the House, I don't know, at least a half dozen times, never had any traction in the Senate. It's passed the House. It headed to the Senate. The committee is recommending it be killed. It will be killed. Meanwhile, the Senate passed a bill that would, you know, almost allow a de facto decriminalization, if a judge and prosecutor would allow them to assign sort of a generic misdemeanor label to something that would free the hands, or at least attempts to free the hands of judges. Some judges would say they already have this authority to essentially treat small-time marijuana possession as a violation-level offense. And so
it sounds like decriminalization.
Yes, except the law would still be on the books, and they would say the police would – and the police are fine with this, which is a big change historically. I think this, according to the chiefs of police, this is the first time they've supported a bill that would do anything to reduce penalties for marijuana use. And they say they're concerned decriminalization would send, in their estimation, it's a green light to young people to use marijuana, whereas this would allow a judge and a prosecutor to look at a young person largely, but anybody who's arrested using marijuana and say, well, you know, do I really want to saddle them with some sort of penalty that could harm them getting a job and going to college and so forth?
Gary.
But the criticism of that bill that we're hearing is that, you know, you're still giving somebody discretion and you're not being consistent about this. And one of the
somebody meaning the judge?
Judge, you know, and one of the things that's been happening, and people will tell you, is if you go get a lawyer and you're charged with simple possession, you go get a lawyer, you get off. But if you're poor and you don't have access to a decent lawyer, then you get some trouble. And when you don't, when you leave it as a misdemeanor, you're leaving the door wide open to that again, where somebody with a lawyer can get it pleaded down. You don't have a lawyer, you might not, you might or you might not get it pleaded down. So we get the two-tiered justice system again. And that's the concern with the Senate bill.
Well, and so it's sort of an attempt to strike a middle ground, Gary, whether it does or not.
Right.
I want to ask you, I mean, there is a contingent in the House that always votes for decriminalization, that always votes for legalization. Will this different approach satisfy them?
I mean, they'll take anything at this point, probably. But, I think what we're going to see is the Senate just will kill off the decriminalization bill from the House. The House is very apt to just turn around and put their decriminalization bill on the Senate bill and send it back to the Senate. And so we'll worry about it in the committee of conference. That's probably what's going to happen.
But it is definitely true that the state, I mean, New Hampshire's the only state in New England that hasn't decriminalized marijuana, that there had been momentum building for some time. And then opioid crisis arrives, and it's pretty clear to people who are real advocates of marijuana decriminalization and legalization that their fight got a lot harder with that as the backdrop.
Well, gentlemen, I wanted to ask you about one headline that you don't hear that often, at least recently here in the Granite State, is that the state received more tax money than expected. So let's talk about this. Revenues coming in over expectations. First off, Gary, just how much more and why?
Well, March is like the largest month for state revenues, largely because of the business taxes due then, and as well as the the business taxes are the big numbers, and they were up $13 million this month. The revenues all overall were $13 million up this month, but for the total year, we're almost $80 million more than the plan flies, and it's $125 million more than what we raised last year. So revenues are flowing in at a very large rate, which is it's number one, it's going to mean that we're going to get the second business tax cut. The trigger will be met. Number two, people are now pushing for other additional tax cuts in the business community.
Well, could we talk about that a little bit? And Dean,
sure.
We talked about this a lot on the Roundup last year, the whole business tax debate where Democrats said, hey, if you reduce business taxes, it will, quote, blow a hole in the state budget. At least right now, it doesn't seem to be the case.
That was part of the holdup with the over finalizing the 2-year budget. This debate between Republicans and Democrats over what to do with surplus tax revenue has been around for pretty much as long as I can remember. You know, typically you can predict what's going to happen when you have these kinds of revenues come in. Republicans call for additional reduction in business taxes, and Democrats usually call for additional spending on programs that might not have been able to be funded under other circumstances. I think the opioid crisis has been kind of one of the central kind of ways in which we've seen this debate this time. There had been some debate over exactly how much money could be spent on a number of different bills. And now Governor Hassan has said, well, we have the extra money. Let's fully fund them. And, other people kind of jump into the fray and say, OK, now that we have this money, maybe we should do X, Y or Z. And so there's just kind of a classic philosophical debate about how to use revenue between the two parties.
What are you hearing about this, Josh, this idea of there might be, extra money?
Well, it makes it easier for backers of, there are a couple of bills before the legislature one would change the deduction of capital costs for business. Those have to be overtaken as depreciation. This would allow one-time deductions. There are two proposals. One is more generous than the other. Whether or not that would reduce revenues. The Department of Revenue said it would reduce revenues to the state. There'll be a fight about that. The whole way in which states tax IPOs, the so-called Planet Fitness issue that was attempted to be addressed last year, failed when the governor opposed it.
So some of those efforts are coming back.
In a different form. I think the revenue situation makes it a lot more likely that those get to her desk, and when they do get there, it may be a little bit more of a sensitive call than it was last time for her, whether or not she vetoes them. But it's she's been pretty clear that she's skeptical about things that are going to reduce revenue. But, the money's coming in, so we'll see where we end up.
Again, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800 892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, I want to flip back to politics and look once again at that U.S. Senate race between incumbent Kelly Ayotte and Governor Maggie Hassan. We talked earlier in the program about the political implications for Governor Hassan with her husband being the principal at Phillips Exeter and what Kelly Ayotte has said about that. So we won't go over that ground again. But Josh, Senator Ayotte had what was called a cordial meeting with President Obama's Supreme Court nominee this week. What's the implication of that?
Well, cordial but firm for now that she's not changing her position, that she does not believe a nomination shall be dealt with until the election. And so she said that she met with Merrick Garland, had a conversation, but reiterated her view that the people need to weigh in November. And so, you know, she's very much in line with the bulk of Senate Republicans, although in the smaller subset, a lot of whom are facing re-election, who have agreed to meet with Merrick Garland. Some facing re-election have called for votes, and some not facing re-election, like Susan Collins of Maine, and said, we ought to vote on this.
What about these meetings, Dean? Is this sort of a middle ground to look like you're at least being polite, or what does that accomplish?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is kind of custom, and part of it is what is Josh is suggesting, that you have, members who are up for re-election in particularly in swing states where there's a lot of pressure on this issue. So, you know, they're trying to kind of either have it both ways or walk a fine line. You know, I think the most likely scenario is if, you know, Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders are elected in the fall, they will still have an opportunity to kind of very quickly in the lame duck session approve this confirmation. They could do that, or, you know, it depends on what the, you know, there may be some discussion about who gets to do this, because, you know, the new president may want to have their own nominee. We wouldn't know that until we see who's elected. So, you know, in the meantime, it just seems to be a stalemate. And this is an interesting, you know, this is something that, you know, I view it as more of kind of an institutional process. But it has become highly politicized. So, you know, I wasn't persuaded by Democratic arguments about waiting way back when Joe Biden and others were making those arguments. And I'm not persuaded now by Republicans who are making the same arguments. It's kind of a political partisan overlay on what should be an institutional process. And, you know, the Republicans are basically saying, well, you know, President Obama's already had two. That's enough. That's a political decision. That's not an institutional decision. And so, you know, this idea that there needs to be an election when we've already had two elections for President Obama. So I view it for both parties. I'm not picking on one part or the other. I found it unpersuasive with Democrats years ago. I find it unpersuasive now with Republicans. Best case scenario for Garland is that they run this through very quickly in the fall if a Democrat wins the presidency. A worst case scenario, whoever the next president in puts up a different nominee.
Well, we got a lot of comments on Facebook on this. I'll just share a few with you. Meredith says, does she, meaning Ayotte, really think that just meeting with him makes her appear more reasonable than her fellow obstructionists? James says, New Hampshire went to Obama in both elections. We've already expressed ourselves with our votes twice. Andrea says, the people have had a voice every 4 years. The current president has a constitutional right and obligation to nominate a justice. One more question on this U.S. Senate race. Josh, to you first, please. Lots of outside money coming in from what I've read. From what kind of groups, Josh? Who's getting involved in this New Hampshire U.S. Senate race?
Well, I mean, in addition to the outside, I mean, basically, you know, activist groups on both sides who support causes near and dear to the base of both parties. And Ayotte and Hassan are also raising their own money at a pretty fast clip. You know, I think they've both raised about $4.5 million personally thus far. But, you know, the bulk of the money in this race is likely to be outside money, and the total is likely to top what was spent in Gene Shaheen and Scott Brown's race, although it's hard to know. And that, I think that total was like, $55 million, yeah. The bulk of that being money from outside groups. And, you know, we're a long way from November, and we don't know who the nominees are going to be, and we don't know, you know, these outside groups, they have a lot of money, but they don't like to waste it. And so they make their calls about where they think they're going to spend. And so a lot of these decisions have yet to been made, but this is seen by everybody as a real top-tier contest where you have two candidates of, you know, equal stature, and the balance of the Senate may be at stake, and so a lot of money, and a lot of money focused around frankly, the Garland nomination so far, both by the Senate minority, the PAC, the run by the Harry Reid affiliate PAC, and you know, conservative groups, you know, pushing for AI to hold the line.
Yeah, I've seen some of those ads and so forth on that issue. It sounds almost like 2014 again with that U.S. Senate race here in New Hampshire that got so much attention. We'll talk more in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Join us as we talk about some of the top Granite State headlines of the week. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests this week are Dean Spiliotis, Gary Reno, and Josh Rogers. And again, you can join us by email, exchange at nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. A couple more political headlines to cover, guys, and then I do want to talk about the surprising decision by New Hampshire Fish and Game to cancel that controversial bobcat hunt. But first, in the New Hampshire governor's race, Republican Executive Counselor Chris Sununu received the endorsement of former U.S. Senate nominee Scott Brown. And I'll turn to you first, Dean, I think. What did Scott Brown say?
Well, you know, he's supported Chris Sununu. He thinks, you know, he's kind of the best choice. I mean, Scott Brown, you got to remember, was sort of a fairly grand scheme of things, a fairly moderate Republican. Some people are arguing that, you know, Chris Sununu as well is kind of it will be a little bit more moderate than some of the other candidates running for the Republican nomination for governor. So I think he tapped into that. We had quite a race between Shaheen and Brown for Senate. And there's always kind of been some question ever since then, you know, is Scott Brown really going to kind of commit to getting involved in the politics of the state over time? He had those Scott Brown, the barbecues with all the presidential candidates. So he tried to get involved there. So I am interested to see, you know, beyond this endorsement, to what extent Brown wants to be a player in kind of state politics going forward. But I think, you know, it doesn't surprise me. I think Sununu is kind of a good fit for him in terms of somebody he might endorse. I'm someone who's sort of ambivalent about the impact of these endorsements.
How helpful they really
are.
Yeah,
but it kind of keeps the candidate's name in discussion.
And I think, too, that Chris Sununu's father, John H., the former governor and GOP chair, was one of the first people who was really pushing Brown to get into the U.S. Senate race, particularly after his son decided he didn't really want to go at it again. So, I mean, it's not surprising that he would be backing Chris Sununu.
Well, another question about the upcoming races this fall, you know, concerning super PACs and their money. And we talked about this just a minute ago in terms of the U.S. Senate race this year between Ayotte and Hassan. We're used to hearing about these, Gary, in terms of Senate races and presidential elections. But this week, the New Hampshire Priorities PAC announced its plans for the fall elections. Now, who is this group and what are its priorities?
Well, it's a group that was put together largely by Peter T. Paul, who, if we know the Peter T. Paul College of Business at the University of New Hampshire, he donated about $25 million to establish that college. And he, in the past, has been a supporter of Dan Innes, who was running for Congress, who was also the dean of the college. Put about $500,000 into Innes's campaign a couple of years ago, but Innes has withdrawn for various reasons, and now this PAC is saying it's going to get involved in executive council races, state senate races, and house races in New Hampshire. Probably not going to get into the governor's race, but they are looking for people who are quote unquote offering fiscally responsible solutions to issues that impact the state. And they're saying that it's not necessarily just a Republican PAC, that they're looking for both Democrats and Republicans who are going to do that.
What does this say to you, Dean, that this group is getting involved at the micro level?
Well, it's interesting. It's exactly the question I was thinking of. We've seen increasingly in recent election cycles with these every 2 year cycles that kind of the politicization of running for office, the kind of politics of the campaign has really kind of trickled down to the micro level. Executive council races now involve a fair bit of politics and fundraising. You see more and more people running for what are essentially volunteer positions in the state legislature, raising significant funds or committing more money to campaigning. So, I mean, this is an example of where getting involved at the local level could make a difference. You know, there are not a lot of resources. Having a super PAC weigh in on your behalf could make the difference. So I think it's really interesting to see how the money is kind of trickling down to the local level now.
Josh.
Well, I mean, the potential for, you know, for lack of a better term, return on investment is probably higher at the state house than it would be elsewhere. A little bit of money here and there might get people in office who see things your way. And depending on who's in the corner office, I mean, we've seen that the state house can swing, you know, rather dramatically. And, you know, policies can get made more quickly there than in Washington.
And I think the amount of money that's going into these races has been growing very rapidly over the last few years. I mean, it used to be $60,000 or $70,000 was what an executive counselor would raise, and I mean now that's well into the $150,000-$200,000 range. State senate races, you know, $50,000 was an expensive race. Now we're talking into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. So I mean, the money has just grown just exploded, basically, what it's costing to run these races compared to what it was.
Okay, I have to ask you this question, Dean. I mean, what is the impact on New Hampshire politics, meaning, you know, the bills that get passed, the bills that don't, with all these outside or, in some instances, inside groups playing a role in, you know, at the State House? I mean, my goodness, there's this 424 members there.
It's already complicated and chaotic enough as it is, right? This is a good question. You know, we've studied it a lot at the national level, given the millions and eventually billions of dollars that are being spent by outside groups. And it's hard to say for sure, you know, exactly what the return on investment is. You know, to some extent, it makes the kind of policy environment, the political environment kind of more chaotic. It makes it harder for politicians and officials to kind of control the message because you have these outside groups weighing in. I do think there are examples where it could conceivably tip the balance. I think some of it is wasted on the other hand. But it really is just kind of a different way of aggregating individual interests. I mean, we think about interest groups. They're really aggregators of interests of particular constituencies to have a stronger voice on policy. So I think I honestly believe it's kind of a mixed bag. I think there are advantages to it, but I also think it kind of, in some sense, just sort of increases kind of the chaotic nature of the policymaking environment. So we don't really know yet for sure.
I think one of the things you can say that it has done is that it's nationalized the legislature that we see. I mean, we're getting national issues brought into New Hampshire. Yeah. We don't see it going the other way.
And you know, when I first noticed this really was with Bill O'Brien. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that when he was speaker, a lot of the kind of his sort of core agenda really matched up very closely with the core agenda of the Tea Party nationally. And you really started to see this kind of sort of connection between local and national really movement politics.
Well, speaking of chaos, Josh Rogers, there was some chaos in the first congressional district race on the Democratic side. First of all, Josh, a lot of folks, you know, we've heard about the Republican primary in the first congressional district. A lot of folks probably didn't even know there was a Democratic primary. So who's in that race?
Well, Carol Shea Porter, who's obviously been in and out of Congress representing the first district, and Sean O'Connor lives in Bedford, used to run a test prep company, you know, made a decent amount of money doing that, is challenging her. He was first in the race. He was actually first looking at potentially running for U.S. Senate and then decided not to do that and has cast his lot in the first district. And he's claiming that people close to Shea Porter, including people who are in her employ as well as close political allies, mounted what he's described as a whisper campaign to discredit him by suggesting that he was involved in domestic abuse. He says, as the abuser, he says that he was, in fact, the victim of domestic abuse, you know, has an affidavit from the person who assaulted him, apparently, and says that he is thinking about a defamation lawsuit against the Shea Porter campaign. He alleges specifically that this whisper campaign was mounted at a time when he was going to be able to speak at a Bernie Sanders rally close to the primary. He was a Sanders supporter, and that Shea Porter's people sought to scuttle that by spreading this rumor to the effect of, oh, do you really want that guy speaking? He's been involved in domestic abuse. And he the Shea Porter folks essentially have said that this is simply not true, although not all of them are on the record. And a lot of the reporting on this has been done by WMUR and NH1. NH1 had Sean O'Connor on the other night, and he actually named names, including Caroline French, who's a longtime ally of Shea Porter, Naomi Andrews, and I think Carol Perry. And WMUR reported Caroline French, you know, denies this. The Shea Porter campaign has denied this. The Bernie Sanders campaign, the Julia Barnes, who is his state campaign manager, has not explicitly denied that this rumor might have been going around, but has issued a statement essentially saying supportive of Carol Shea Porter. And Sean O'Connor, meanwhile, is getting more attention than he's gotten before. Whether or not this will pay off politically for him, the voters will decide. But it's certainly been a weird turn.
Gary.
Sort of reminiscent of the Gary Dodd campaign, you know, when the guy was running for Congress. And
this is during the first time when Carol Shea Porter
ran. Yeah. and he ended up, whoever, you know, faking an accident, I guess is what basically people said, and trying to get this publicity for himself to get his name.
That's right. I do remember that. And yeah. So an accident
sort of
was supposedly
little
faked, and then he ran away from the scene and fell into a river. And
something like that.
Right. Okay. Well.
So it seems the same sort of situation going on here.
Well, we will probably be keeping an eye on that primary, as well as the very busy Republican primary in the 1st Congressional District. Again, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange, and you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, we have to talk about a vote that took a lot of people by surprise this week. And Dean Spiliotis, to you first, the Fish and Game Department decided to reverse course, call off the bobcat hunt. Why did they decide to do this?
Yeah. Well, there have been a lot of, as we've discussed in previous roundups, there's been a lot of pushback on this idea of the hunt. There was supposed to be a hunt of, I think, 50, a plan was for 50 permits for bobcats. And, people who opposed it cited some concerns about other more endangered species getting caught up in these traps. There's been some debate over, whether or not the numbers in terms of the population in the state are really accurate. And we heard some sound of the state agency pushing back against that idea. I think they just sort of, given the level of opposition and the fact that the Rules Committee kind of put off approving this, they just felt like they weren't going to make any progress. And so they just decided to, it wasn't going to happen. It seemed like I heard one official say he felt like they would be sort of banging their head against the wall. So they just decided to pull it.
Well, some comments on Facebook. Dana says, can anyone explain to me why all the hype against bobcat hunting and not with other species? And Carolyn says, thank goodness Fish and Game listen to the people. No need for hunting these cats. Another story from the legislature, Gary Reno, that I wanted to ask you about. There was a state lawmaker, relatively new to the legislature, an elderly gentleman, had some health issues, needed an oxygen tank. And you do see people, pulling these around more and more these days. But the folks in charge of safety at the State House said, no, you can't bring that in here.
No, they said you're blocking the aisle and somebody could be prevented from getting out. I mean, it's a sort of – the guy was Ernie Bridge from Unity. He's a first-term representative, had some health issues in January. And the sergeant-at-arms were the ones who told him that. I mean, I look at this and I think that probably this is going to be taken care of very quickly. There are a couple of places where you could have people that are just two seats, and we have a couple of empty positions because they haven't been filled. I mean, this will be very easily taken care of. I'm sure that Sean Jasper will do everything he can to make sure this one goes away.
So is this an instance where it made news before they had a chance to just deal with it internally?
I think that's really the case. Yeah.
Well, we got some comments on it from our listeners. Mm-hmm. Norma says, kind of what you said, Gary, seems to me there must be some reasonable accommodation that's available here. John says, so it's okay to have firearms in the chamber, but not equipment to support someone's health needs. John says, that's about the most ludicrous thing I've ever heard. So that's a sampling of some of our Facebook comments.
Gun block the aisle.
So just don't block the aisle. That's the message.
Maybe the gun will go off and hit the oxygen tank, and then we'll have a real problem.
Well, I did want to ask you, Josh Rogers, too, about another quick story. We keep touching on the presidential campaign. Corey Lewandowski, Donald Trump's campaign manager from New Hampshire. So some people here have followed this story with interest. He got into trouble a couple weeks ago in Florida for an incident where he was charged with battery. What's happening with this now, with this case?
Well, the prosecutors in Florida say they're not going to pursue this. A lot of people said they saw this coming. Who knows? The incident was captured on video. This is a reporter for Breitbart who said that Corey Lewandowski grabbed her. She was trying to talk to Donald Trump and yanked on her arm. Her initial report said he tried to pull her to the ground. Security camera footage shows Lewandowski. Lewandowski totally denied. He said, "I don't know her. I never touched her. And there's nothing to this." Security footage did show that he, in fact, did grab Michelle Fields, that's the name of the reporter, by the arm and, you know, kind of pull her away from Donald Trump. This obviously caused a big uproar about, as do most things about the Trump campaign. Trump stood by Lewandowski, also went after this reporter, Michelle Fields. Prosecutors aren't gonna go there. The Trump issued a statement saying that this issue is settled. It certainly is, as far as prosecutors go. You know, Corey Lewandowski is a hard-charging, you know, political fellow. We've all dealt with him at the State House. And, you know, he's been getting a lot of scrutiny as the fortunes of Donald Trump have risen. There's an interesting article in the Times this morning that takes a look at some of his activities in Windham, where he lives, and it sort of being local, kind of small government gadfly, basically.
He used to be the head of
Americans
AFP
for Prosperity
here
in New Hampshire.
Yes, sure,
yes.
Sure. And he's and been he on this program a number of times.
Yeah, and he worked for Bob Smith's 2002 Senate campaign,
yeah, and
among other things.
And he has been a little bit less visible with the campaign since this happened. I mean, the campaign is shifting now to dealing with kind of delegate issues for the convention, so there are a different group of people who seem to be running the show. You know, I think for me the bigger issue was, I mean, the incident is what it was. People can watch the video. But, you know, what was so troubling was, you know, initially they said it never happened, and Corey Lewandowski said he didn't even know this woman. I mean, it was clearly – it's just not being honest, which is a separate issue from whether or not this rises to the level of battery. I haven't followed up completely yet, but there was some suggestion yesterday. I read that Secret Service video and Secret Service affidavit have suggested that she had been warned, not to be close to Trump, and that she was in an off limits area, et cetera, et cetera, and that in some way the Secret Service affidavit and video persuaded the prosecutors not to go forward. But again, for me, you know, for whatever the assault was, it was the way they handled it that was so problematic.
Well, as they used to say in D.C., it's not the crime, it's the cover-up.
The cover-up.
That's the
exactly.
Phrase. So all of you, real quick, we've got about 40 seconds here. Gary Reno, what are you going to be covering next week?
Well, the legislature is still in session and going great guns, and one of the things I'm going to be watching is this bill on the drug courts.
Okay. Yes, that's a big deal. We've talked about that a lot on this program. Josh, how about you? What are you working on next
week?
Well,
I'll be keeping an eye on that and also trying to get out and see the, you know, the growing slate of candidates we have running for, you know, we've got wide open races for governor, for instance.
Okay.
Yeah, it's full. We're in full statewide politics mode at this point. You've got seven people running for governor alone, so there's plenty to look at beyond the presidential race. I'm just following all of that.
That's enough to keep a political analyst happy.
Absolutely.
Right there. Never mind all
no
the other races. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Sure.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producer is Faith Mikesell, with help from Jessica Hunt. And I'm Laura Kanoy.